Hey, movie lovers, Dimitri Panos here for Popcorn Talk Network's Anatomy of a Movie. So if you've been searching for that movie show to talk about searching, well, you've found us right here. Stay tuned.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's Anatomy of a Movie.
Hey again, movie fans, Dimitri Panos here for Popcorn Talk Network's Anatomy of a Movie. And you've searched all your life for the greatest movie show dissecting movies, and you have now found us. And today we are actually talking about Searching the Movie. So along with me is my fantastic co-host. We've been doing this for like 5 years, folks.
Yeah.
Five years.
September 2013 is when we started.
Yep. And like 450 shows under our belt. Mm-hmm. We're almost into syndication.
One would think we like movies.
One would think that we like movies. Maybe. And today's unlike any other day. We're here to talk movies along with you. Before we get along with the show, you should know that we are very spoiler rich. And in a movie like Searching, that's important. I will. And I know, Marissa, you're going to back me up on this.
Yeah.
If you have not seen Searching, do not watch our show. Because I think part of what makes Searching what it is the fact that you don't know.
Yeah, it's the adventure.
Yeah, it really is. It really, yeah. So, tune out, go see the movie, come back. We are up forever in posterity because we're online. Perpetuity. And yeah, we're just up there. So, I got to tell you that right now. If you haven't seen the movie, click off our show. As much as I hate to tell people to leave us, but you really should see the movie first and come back because then you'll enjoy the conversation.
Go search for this movie in the theater.
Yeah.
Watch it. Then come back and search for us.
Search for us.
Talking about Searching.
And then you'll enjoy the conversation so much more. And you won't be pissed off when you say, they ruined the movie.
Yeah. Spoiler right now.
You have been warned. And for those people who have coming back and who have seen the movie, welcome. And so Marissa, 5 years, 550 shows. We always start off pretty much the same way all the time. Mm-hmm. What did you think of Searching?
I really enjoyed it. I heard from other people before I went to go see this film that it was really good. I was like, all right, I'm all in. I like a good thriller. I think what the movie does so well, it's so in today's modern society of technology that you can accept it and appreciate it for what it is. Will it age well? Maybe not, knowing how advanced technology gets so fast. So in 20 years, is it going to be like mind-boggling? Probably not. But for what it is and what it accomplished, amazing. Awesome. And it had a good storyline with emotional beats underneath. There was a lot of humanistic qualities that it appreciates and a good story. For movie going, I really enjoyed it. I went into it not really expecting everything that, like, I didn't know what to expect more so. Mm-hmm. And then I went out and I was like, wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Great film. More people need to see this.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you. I think this is a really good movie. I'm going to answer your question too, because I think it's a very good question. I think it's a great question for conversation, but I actually looked at this movie and I see this movie. I think it's a really great mystery. And that's what it is.
Yeah.
It's a modern day original mystery. I think the best that I've seen. And again, I'm specifying and making it a point to put it out there, all blocks, original mystery since like movies like Brick. And the reason why I say that is we had like movies like Murder on the Orient Express. Which was a remake, and it's based off a book. Same thing with Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. It's based off a book. This isn't really based off of a book or anything. It's an original mystery, and it has everything mystery lovers love. I mean, you have suspense. It's not a horror movie. It was sort of built that way, but it's not a horror movie, but it definitely has that suspense. It's a good potboiler. It has red herrings throughout the entire movie, and there are smart red herrings, and it has good twists. You mentioned humanistic. Couldn't agree with you more there. When prior to walking in here, we were talking about last week's movie. We were talking about the Happy Time Murders, and I said I was going to make a comparison because one thing that I think is very special about Searching is when you break it down, you see the trailer and such, it's a gimmick movie. The gimmick being you're watching everything from a computer or a tablet screen or a television monitor, something like that, right?
There's an artistic flair to it. Correct. Than other films usually don't
It's almost like a watching a live version of like a Dateline.
Yeah, that's what everyone's comparing this film to.
So, but the interesting thing here is the gimmick only works because it has a very strong, taut, engrossing story. The story brings you in. To answer your question, 10 years from now, the story is still going to work. The story is what drives this, not how I'm watching it, which was clever, okay? Unlike Happy Time Murders, which too is a gimmick movie, the story was so weak, the gimmick does not work. So I can use this comparison today to say where it failed. On one hand, here, a gimmick really works because you're engrossed. It really draws you in. You forget that you're looking, that this is a movie being shown to you via TV screens and whatever, because it's done so clever and you're engrossed in the story.
Right, and it still pulls you in as a viewer, as Absolutely. An audience member. And I think it does well because our society, in the demographic that is currently watching this film, is already used to watching those type of screens. So we're used to our eyes going a million different places on one location of a screen, going to FaceTime, going to Skype, going to X, Y, and Z Messenger, you know? Like, we're used to having at least 3 to 4 windows open on one monitor.
Right.
So watching it in a movie, we're actually conditioned to do it already.
Yeah, we are. But here's the thing, too, is that it uses today's technology of, let's just call it modern-day communication. Because that's what it is. It's it's via FaceTime chat. It's via social media. The way in which John Cho's character was trying to find his missing daughter, Margot, was all through these various today
social media platforms.
So, yes, it is a sign of today. But I take it a step further because I really thought that the story was so strong that as a mystery, like, it'll work 10 years from now for someone who first sees it. And I really thought that it was a really brilliant exercise. Really, I really did. I really walked out of the movie going, wow, I just saw something very good.
Right. And this is a movie where the execution works.
Perfect.
Where I said last week on Happy Time Murders, we're going to make that comparison. The execution was not there. And this is a movie that was so planned out. With the story, with visuals, with everything, and we'll definitely get into it. This is a movie with a great solid concept and a great solid execution.
Yeah, it really was. And it didn't have an ending that I felt cheated.
No.
I bought it.
Yeah.
I bought it.
It was earned.
It was very well earned. And it was earned from the way that it was written, earned from the way everything was performed. I think John Cho, very versatile actor to begin with, but I think he really, this is a movie that stands, that he has to shoulder himself, and I think it's one of his best performances of his career. We already know he can do comedy. Harold and Kumar, he's great, right? He has
American
good chemistry.
Pie. I'm going to take it back to American Pie.
I mean, he has good chemistry with people, and in this movie, it looks like he has good chemistry with the people that he works with and around, whether behind or in front of the camera. Really solid. He took everything seriously, you can tell. But everybody in this movie, I think, really helped with that too. The performances are strong. Part of why you get drawn into this story, like what happened. It wasn't cheap, earned.
Right, and that's the thing also with this film, is that if you think about it, we only see maybe about 5 people. With like actual speaking roles that play a pivotal part in the movie. Like maybe generally 5 people. That's not a lot. That's literally one, like you can count them on one hand. Whereas other films, it got so lost in an ensemble.
Yeah.
But with the short amount of cast that they had, they executed so much on screen. Yeah,
they did.
So, and I think that's a testament to the actors that they can convey so much and engross us into a story and the character development and relationship with everyone with so little people.
Yeah, and you know, I got to use the word you probably hear the word engrossing a lot, but, you know, you can lose. Look, if the story wasn't there, you would lose interest. I don't care. It's social media. I'd be like, yeah, all right, I get it. I'm not interested. But this brings you into such a way that you somewhat forget about what these various technologies, and you're really pulled in to say, wow, what's going on here? What's happening here? And then you go on the journey with the dad and with David, and you feel his anger, you feel his frustration, his despair. And then they start throwing in these red herrings. And the movie just works. It's a good mystery.
Yeah.
And it comes to a very satisfying conclusion that I didn't like really dealt. And there are little things peppered here and there. So why don't we just start talking about some of this movie?
Yeah.
And about, you know.
Well, we can get into the development
sure.
of it. Timur Bekmambetov.
Yes.
He was one of the producers of the film Unfriended that came out a few years ago. I believe you and Phil actually.
Yeah, another movie and the sequel had just come out. It's another movie that uses modern social media tropes and using it as communications.
Yeah, so it was that production company. They wanted to make more projects like Unfriended and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And they recruited Anish Shiganti, who was the director of this film, after they had seen his viral video that went up on Google. Like, he shot it all in Google Glass. It was called Seeds, and it went viral.
Yeah.
And they liked what he could do with technology, and they brought him and Sev O'Hanahan, who was also co-writer of this film, to see what they can, pitch a story and see what they can do with technology on screen.
Yeah, and their whole draw, or what inspired them too, is to do a hyper-modern thriller told via the technology and the devices too. That's the other thing too. The devices being used that we use every day to communicate, and not just by a phone, but by video. Video that this thing was used a lot. Mm-hmm. And then this is turned into this mystery. I think it's really great that is a Shiganti and Ohanian?
Yeah.
Okay, so they met at the USC film production class. Rohanian was a graduate teaching assistant, and Shiganti was one of his, he calls him a strong student.
Yes.
So, you know, what's he going to do with his film partner? He's a weak student now, with his strong student. And he said Anish always had the best ideas, good work ethic, mm-hmm. Positive energy, inquisitive mind, and you just had the sense that he could do something great. So those are actually, you know, when it comes to talent and putting it forward, those three things: work ethic, positive energy, inquisitive mind. It's all right there for you. So
they partnered up.
Yeah,
creatively.
They became writing partners.
Yeah,
and that is so cool.
Yeah, so. And Shiganti, because of their short film Seeds that went viral and was so successful that Google actually hired him mm-hmm. to direct a bunch of Google commercials and projects and stuff for 2 years.
Yeah.
And then Shiganti actually left Google to make this film.
Right.
So Shiganti, he has a lot of experience within just modern day technology, Google and searching, and he knows how to direct already.
It's like Google and searching.
Yeah, you see, it does go hand in hand. And so he already has the skill set of how technology works and on social media and how to properly look for things.
You're right.
And so visually he already had the ideas, the concept.
And visually and the ideas, but the thing is too, what's great about this movie is how it's used as a tool. Almost like a good special effect. A good special effect is used as a tool. It could make a movie better, but the story is what counts, right? Because ultimately, what I found really great about this movie is it's a father's journey about his daughter. Let's talk a little story too here. You know, the movie opens up and it has what many are calling an up moment. Because
we're definitely an up. That's all I thought of.
Right. And
Disney Pixar's up.
Look at that. That hit me hard. Anything where there's a loss of life of a loved one due to a cancer.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, I didn't know that it was part of the story. I'm like, oh, okay. I can't run away from those movies. It's not advertised. If it is advertised, I usually do go the other way for obvious reasons. But they draw you in. And then it's about father. You should watch the movie, Siri.
Darn it, Siri.
Then it becomes father-daughter relationship. And I mean, it's mm-hmm. and it's a very emotional beat. Okay. It brings you in. And I liked how it was a father and trying to salvage this relationship or nurture it. And at the end of the day, he's like, I don't know my daughter. And it wasn't because of technology. What I love about this movie. It wasn't because of the technology that's being used. It's because how he had closed himself off. And then we see through various...
How she closed herself off, too. And I think the brilliance of this film is that the whole importance of connectivity and disconnectivity.
Mm-hmm.
Because we always say social media and all this technology, it's actually been conducive to our disconnect with actual human emotions, how we can't have normal conversations face-to-face with people.
Face, right.
But also, yes, that is a weakness in society now, but this film also uses it as a strength to help search for the people that you're looking mm-hmm. for. So, yeah. Yes, it was a weakness. And, like, you can tell that she used it for her... She was trying to find herself.
Sure.
Search for her happiness, whatever.
Yeah.
Via the technology and social media. But also, it showed us how disconnected she was from everybody else.
Yeah, yeah. And again, it's a very humanistic... It's a very humanistic approach. And that's what really drives you in. And it's not because of the technology. And it wasn't that I was finding that they were disconnected. You could argue that technology played a part in it, but it's because of the situation. They each closed themselves down from one another and opening themselves up to the feelings that they felt. It wasn't that they had any lack of love. It was just, how do you compartmentalize this? I found those aspects of this movie to be tremendous.
Also, it helped with character building.
No kidding.
That they didn't fully establish the character of Margot because we don't know who she is. The audience isn't supposed to know who she is. Therefore, all the twists that come in, we're like, we don't know what to expect because we don't know this person.
Right.
She could have ran away. She could have been abducted. She could have been X, Y, and Z only because we only know snippets of her life. We don't know her personally.
Yeah, and from a script construct, I mean, it really works because introduced as a family, they're all happy and loving, and we're seeing all this via video flashback.
Mm-hmm.
The up moment happens. It's very emotional. And then you see that father and daughter can communicate, and it seems like happy-go-lucky-ish. Like the way that they're texting to one another, you know, hey, what did you forget today? And he takes a picture and blah, blah, blah,
right.
You know. So, and then when she starts to become distant, and again, this happens within the first 15, 20 minutes of the movie, if not sooner, right?
Yeah,
first
10,
15
minutes.
Yeah. And when that night comes where he boozes it up, David drinks a little, takes a sleeping pill. And he goes to sleep, and then you see that Margot tries calling three mm-hmm. times, FaceTime, whatever. As the audience member, that's when
you're like, oh, crap, something's happening.
Exactly. And then you're drawn in. And by that time, I'm not even paying attention, or I forget that I'm watching these screens, and I'm like, oh, Jesus. Mm-hmm. And then our mystery starts to unravel, and using searching modes, trying to find who her friends are, trying to find, and there's these little pieces of the puzzle. Did you notice by any chance, and I think it's very important, I think it was done on purpose. So there was a picture of Margot when she was going into high school, and she was standing in front of the name of the high school, mm-hmm. and at the bottom, you know how like high schools will always say, AB High School, home of the Badger.
Yeah.
Or did you notice what it said in the bottom?
No.
It said so-and-so high school, home of the catfish. So I was like, huh, okay.
Well, you know, I actually had a moment where I thought it was a catfish moment.
Yeah.
And we did get kind of a catfish
moment. Sort of, kind of, right?
I thought that was going to be like the main twist was like, oh, it's definitely catfishing.
Yeah,
something happened to it because of catfishing.
That was right.
We got
there.
A snippet of that.
You got a snippet.
I was like, I was
of
kind
it?
Of right.
Right.
I wasn't wrong. But
right.
It wasn't full. I wasn't fully correct though.
Yeah, and again, just the strength of the script.
Jesus, catfish has a mascot.
I think that was heavy-handed. That's why it stuck out, because it says home of the catfish. What catfish? What do you fry it? Like,
right.
Like that just leaves your school like, open to too much.
Catfish isn't tasty.
It can be with the right seasoning.
I digress.
But anyways, I just found that I found it to be humorous and ironic, considering that this is a movie that's, you know, all based on communicating via social type of platforms.
Right.
So, and I really do think, too, you know, the prologue of Searching, it does guide through video chats. Calendar entries were very important in this movie as well. Home movies that were shot on phone, right? And it really does. That's the other cool thing is that we did get a sense of Margot through all of that. We got a sense of the girl becoming the teenager. And so we too are going along this family's journey, you know? And I really liked how that was set up because, again, it's an unorthodox way of doing it. It's a different way, but yet we're still, it's like, oh, okay, look at this family. And the parents love their daughter so much.
I think it was very smart how they did this, like,
right?
Say 14, 15 year timeline. They started literally at the birth.
Yep.
Of Margot, and then like year by year, and you can see the moments of the relapse with the mother, and like this year, and even just the subtle effect of when you talked about the calendar dates, like mom comes home on this day, they moved it to another day, then they eventually deleted it, like you know it didn't happen.
Sure.
Something like that was very effective emotionally paired with the music, and we'll get into music too.
Yeah.
But I think it was just done so effortlessly that you clearly understood what was happening already in this quick timeline of establishing a family.
Yeah. So, and Shigani and Hunanian, I don't want to mess
Ohanian?
Up there. Ohanian. You know, they were actually, the way that they just came up with that opening scene, they basically pitched it to each other. They almost came up with the idea at the same time through their communication via text. Mm-hmm. And it ended up being, and they even call it themselves, the opening scene in the movie Up. We thought that approach translated through screen life. And lo and behold, it did.
Yeah.
And it could create characters, people that we cared about. And so it's great that these young filmmakers are being inspired by previous very good works of film, by the way, like Up, and saying, well, how can we repurpose and do this in a current way today that's not animation?
But also, you can tell a lot about someone's personality via their desktop, too. And I love when they went back to the Windows XP, because I had Windows XP for years. So I was like, I'm very familiar with this user interface. So I actually enjoy that. But the different profiles. And I think they use that to a great effect, too, because you had the mother. You had Margot's personal. You had the father's. And I think it's really cool, because every time you went into someone different profiles, you get like different pictures, different backgrounds. One's messy desktop, one's another clean one. It's like going into someone's purse.
Yeah.
You can understand like who that person is.
Sure.
Going into someone's.
I don't have one, but yes.
But you know what I mean. But like going into someone's personal profile on their computer,
absolutely.
You get a clear understanding of who this type of person is.
Absolutely. Well, it was that opening segment that actually helped convince John Cho that this screen life storytelling experiment might work. He said the bulk of the work is done in that opening montage. And if that speaks to you, if that gets you, then you're in. And absolutely correct. And You know, he goes on, he goes, then you're in and you accept the premise of the movie because you know who that family is. And again, I think the opening is extremely important to the events that happen in this movie. And again, you know, when we talk a lot of Pixar movies here too, and many of them will have a big emotional beat at the beginning of the movie.
Oh yeah.
Like Up or even Coco or something.
Because you're trying to for those films, not to constantly make the comparisons, but those films a lot of kids are watching.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to get the kids' attention quickly.
Right.
And if you don't, then you, like, what's the point of watching the rest of the film? So if you don't get their, grab their attention in the first 10 minutes, then other point.
And, but what I respect about these filmmakers and writers here is that they didn't want you to be brought in by the technology. They wanted you to be brought in by the story.
Mm-hmm.
They knew that they were using this as a tool, but what's strong? It's the character development.
But also, they also established that Margot was such a happy kid.
Yes.
Seemingly happy person growing up.
Oh,
with
absolutely.
Her seemingly happy family.
They were a happy family.
Oh, yeah.
Until tragedy strikes. It changes people.
But very realistic.
Very realistic. I really enjoyed that. And I was hooked. I mean, I had an emotional, I understood it. I was like, all right. And then the movie starts to go on and I'm, you know, but I understood. What was fantastic is you understood David's grief, mourning, pain, anger, confusion, fear of every single thing that he was going through,
mm-hmm.
of the emotions that he had to do. And that goes to John Cho. He was so fantastic, I thought, in this movie. So in any ways, to prepare for the shoot, Shigani borrowed a system he'd used at Google called prototyping. So, and that's a similar to motion picture industry for pre-viz process.
Mm-hmm.
And in prototyping, they created a version of the project ahead of time with a lot of temp footage and material that they gathered on their own. So Anish had been used to that kind of a workflow from working at Google, doing all this stuff.
Right.
He just used what he was comfortable with. And I find that too is like you're using your talents. You're thinking out of the box. You're using your previous experience to go on, gain new experience. You're doing something new. I really find that that's really cool. So it's a new way of doing pre-viz. We talk about pre-viz a lot
on this show. Often. Yeah, their entire mock-up. This is how far in advance that they thought about this film. They edited, or they hired their editors 7 weeks in advance, did an actual shot-by-shot mock-up of, like, the framing and blocking of where computer screens would be, and even went through blocking heavily with John Cho to make sure that his eye line was in the correct places wherever the mouse clicked. It's because they were recording his eye line in real time, so they had to think of everything. This is where, say, the FaceTime is on the left side of the screen. Your eyes has to be here, so, just to that detail, they could have mirrored images, whatever, and to cheat that. But no, in real time, recording his eyeline for every click he's moving the mouse. Wow.
I'm going to tell you, I want to talk about a scene because you mentioned blocking. And I was thinking of this while watching this movie because there's a great scene that takes place in David's house, John Cho. I believe it was David's house, mm-hmm. where he set up multiple security cameras. This is where he's going to confront his brother, one of the red herrings of the movie, right? And it's supposed to be this tense scene. And we're going from kitchen to here to the living room and this. And that scene does not work unless it is rehearsed over and over and it becomes muscle memory for the two actors because they have to hit marks because you've got so many cameras recording what's happening. I really
thought
that
that was... It's like live theater. You only have one location, you have to hit every mark.
I thought it was a great scene. And again, I'm not paying attention to how I'm watching it. I'm paying attention to the story. And that was a tense scene. Do you agree? Like that, oh, that's, you know, the scene I'm talking. Yeah.
And I think it just adds with anxiety because this is like one of the first twists in the movie where you're like, oh, crap. Maybe now you're suspecting the brother. Right. Because I do watch a lot of Criminal Minds. I just have the aforementioned like knowledge of like a lot of abductions.
Right.
Are generally done by people you know within your inner circle, within right. your close friends or your family. And right. when they went as close to a brother, I was like, oh, shoot, it could be him. So I just already had this anxiety that it could be a family member. That's an emotional twist. And it was something it was such a serious type of situation where you think it could be sexual.
I know.
And it's disgusting.
And you know what was great is the way in which it built. The information that we're given as the audience, and David is given, the way he finds it, and it, like I said, it's one of the biggest, if not the biggest, it's one of the biggest red herrings in the movie, because it really throws you off, because this is what you're being led to believe, and this is how a mystery works. You're eating up all the they're tossing breadcrumbs down for you. Mm-hmm. They are like, they're purposely misleading you, but you're eating the breadcrumbs all the way and you're buying it hook, line, and sinker. And you're like, oh my God, he did this. And then when you find out what it was about, where the audience's mind, where your mind, my mind goes, well, it was originally going, and then it was all about, no, she just wanted to smoke pot. You're like, oh.
And what's also brilliant about they already established that in the beginning.
Yes.
Moments with his brother. Yep. That there was a big pot of weed, and we're like, okay, he's a pothead. All right, but
and he even says, yeah, like it's legal
as
now. Yeah.
As uh-huh. subtle as that establishment for a character was, it still ties back to this scene.
Yeah,
you're like, yeah, that was already set up.
Absolutely,
for us.
And again, that's why, from a story standpoint, a screenplay standpoint, mm-hmm. I felt that red herring was brilliant. I didn't feel cheated at all. You brought me to a place, and then I'm like, oh damn, we haven't figured this out.
Right.
It was only pot. We got to find something.
Also, that scene immediately leads you into the next twist.
Right. Absolutely.
Because they're sitting on a couch now, and literally the phone is calling, like, we got him. We got him. We're like, oh no, what's next?
What's happening?
So it leads us into the next,
next conflict. Yeah. Yeah. And so we'll talk a little bit too about Deborah Messing, who plays the Detective Vic.
She was brilliant.
She was. And again, she's mostly known for comedy,
mm-hmm.
right?
I've seen her in a lot of drama, actually.
Yeah, and she comes and does this movie. Again, she was taken in by the script, hadn't seen it, you know, she said it didn't read like anything she had read before.
Right. She also said, like, another thing that really drew her in was that she is a mother. And just the characteristic of like losing her child, she couldn't like really. She's like, all right, this feeling that is something that drew her in. Just the she responded to that aspect of character development. Just the thought of losing your child.
Yeah, and she goes on. She goes on saying like, so yeah, the script is different. Everything's different. But she had no idea how different things were until the first day on set. Where she found it to be the most shocking because she had a scene with John and they were never in the same room mm-hmm. together. She goes, it was incredible. Like, I was in one room with a laptop and a GoPro right on laptop. And he was on the other side of the house with his own laptop and his own GoPro. We were actually able to do the scene in real time with this video link. And that's...
And John's in her ear.
Yeah, and I think that's again, you're showing up to set. It's like, wait, okay. And again, movie magic, because they were in the movie, they were in two separate locations.
Yeah.
I just like that they were
in different houses.
I like that they were on set in a house, mm-hmm. and one's just on one side, the other's on the other. That's great. I mean, talk about macro budgeting.
Right. And she also said that was that was also challenging for her as an actress because she's so used to being with the next actor face to face because, you know, you play off of each other. But when you're playing off of your actor via computer screen, that there adds that disconnect to the just the acting behavior of her.
Yeah, absolutely.
So she actually found that challenging.
Yeah, it's yeah, and to your point, like when you're an actor too, and John Cho would be no stranger to acting against green screen, particularly, you know, Star Trek and such, right? So, but doing it this way where you aren't in the same room, but you are interacting, yeah, I could see how at first a little unsettling, like you just got to get into the rhythm of the flow, much like the audience gets into the rhythm of the flow of this movie pretty quickly. So, yeah, and she did a really good job. She did a really good job. Yeah, I
and the establishment of her character was also very interesting too. I don't know if you caught it.
I had
some inklings when when she first introduces herself as Detective Vic, and David is like looking up the first top three links of her,
right?
Of like to check out her credibility and the picture of her in the cons. I was like, that's a very creepy picture. And she wasn't smiling. And I don't know, for those who I like to think I'm a very fast reader. So I was reading the tag. I mean, I missed Catfish earlier, but I was reading the subtext underneath the picture.
Oh, okay.
It was like working with cons and stuff.
Right.
I just instantly thought, I was like, that's a very creepy picture of a bunch of guys.
Yeah.
And she's not smiling, working with cons. That's red flag for me.
Yeah. She was a very straight-faced, no nonsense, character.
She seemed like, and just the establishment of a character, she did a really good job of like, I'm going to help you through this, we're going to find her, X, Y, and Z. You believed her.
You did. Again, this is a trope in movies. We saw it recently in that science fiction movie that we did earlier in the year. Like, it's a trope in movies, like, where the main character who's trying to figure out, like, why his wife or daughter went missing or got murdered.
Annihilation.
It was Upgraded.
Upgrade.
All right, Upgrade. So, remember, like, the guy was coming to the cop going, how come you're not, you know, you got to be working on this more. I mean, that's a familiar trope in a revenge type of a movie or a movie
like
where someone's gone missing.
To the authority figure, be like, and why can't you do more?
Yeah, and exactly. And they used it here, but I felt, to your point, Messing's Detective Vic seemed to be a little bit more sympathetic, and that you actually did feel that she was trying to unearth or lift up every stone. There were always no stone unturned until we get to the end, of course. But I believed her. And in fact, I think one of the hardest things too was, the scene where she has to tell David, like, you got to step back. Like, you're done. Like, I can't.
You're too
emotionally involved. Because David, in essence, became a detective. Mm-hmm. Which, too, is intriguing in a mystery. That's a great trope when you're a regular, everyday guy. Hitchcock uses it. Is thrown into something that person on his own, who doesn't have those skills, have to figure things out.
Yep.
And the scene at the movie theater, which I thought was...
Right.
You know, and it's like you broke
going
the
berserk.
Kid's jaw. Like, you're off. You're off. She basically says you're off the case.
Well, like,
David,
that could be actually now a legal problem with assault.
Right. And you go, wow, he just shot himself. Like, but you understood why.
Yeah.
And again, it's another red herring in the movie. Like, that was yet another red herring that we're thrown off the scent because of this kid.
Now when you detach the father,
right,
you're left all alone.
Yeah. So, but then I was really believing her. She goes, you're screwing up my case. I'm trying to get this done. You're off.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that was like, oh.
And it made her out to be the good person.
It did.
You're like, yeah, listen to the woman.
Listen to her. Because she is trying. That's what you get the sense that character is trying to help David along.
Yeah.
No. So I like that. We should talk too about, Michelle Lah, who plays Margot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she too was really good. I felt for her use when she becomes the teenager and she's in high school and we see her in the flashback, right? At first, as an audience, we view her, okay, as a typical teenager, a little bit rebellious,
mm-hmm.
you know? Oh, yeah, Dad, I gotta go. You know, yeah. that sort of kind of thing. I got study class or whatever.
Study group.
So, but I thought that Michelle Lopp played her pretty well, you know, for the time that she's on
Right, and screen. She's not on screen all that much. No. But you can tell that, like, she loves her father. She is a fairly obedient person. But then when you go through all of her social media
mm-hmm.
accounts and whatnot, and especially that UCAST right. website that we see all of her personal videos, yeah. you're like, okay, she's a very isolated, lonely girl.
Yeah,
like most teenagers, but like to a point where she's so isolated and so cut off from people that you actually worry about what she's capable of.
And I'm glad you brought that up because we are, well, a lot of people, you become insulated by social media, that becomes your
world.
It becomes your world, but it also becomes like people get depressed if they don't get enough likes on certain things.
Mm-hmm.
And people broadcast themselves out there for the attention, to do the attention, you know, like she was doing on that UCAST. And then she found people to talk to. So, and hence the catfishing part comes
yeah.
in.
Another red herring.
Another one.
See, this is
another
where my catfishing one. was. I was like, I don't believe this. I don't trust this at all.
I didn't either.
Fish yeah, and chips.
Yeah. Fish and chips.
Fish and chips.
Yep. So I really found that aspect. Well, number one, it does say a lot about today and potentially going forward. But you did get the sense that she was alone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's why she's doing this. She wanted to feel, when she connected with somebody, she felt it was more of a real connection, fish and chips, than, right. say, with her dad.
And well, and she was also talking about her mother's death and stuff. So it's seems like stuff she didn't want to talk about with her father, but she could talk to complete strangers
yeah.
about. It was therapeutic for her.
Yeah.
And even going through her Instagram and seeing all her photos, the places she likes to go, Serenity. Her
right.
happy place.
Right.
A lot of people always post people like pictures of happy places.
Right.
You know, or, you know, just picturesque places that like make you feel yeah. something.
And that's where we are introduced to fish and chips.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, ooh, okay. And the thing is, it's like we fall for that. That's why I say it's strong. You fall for every single one. Like, ooh, who's this fish and chips? What the? Wait, she's not even in the state? Or whatever, like
right, Pennsylvania.
But yeah, and the
but
search.
Also, I'm sorry, ahead. Nancy.
Because
it throws it with the red herring gimmick.
She had red
with
herring.
Fish and chips was a red herring. I didn't even think about that. I was like, oh yeah, that is literally a red herring, and I thought that was pretty smart.
Yeah, yeah. Home of the catfish. So, not only was it smart, but the way. Pardon me, it ended up being repurposed. Because in a sense, mm-hmm. she really is a red herring. Because the person was a stock, what do you call
it? Stock photo,
photo model. Forgive
and you're
me.
Like, oh, she could be anywhere. She could be anywhere.
Anywhere, anyone. And then when you find out what it is, you're like, oh my God. Well, she was still being catfished, but... It was like a double catfish.
Like she was, someone was using her identity.
Somebody was using
her
one of her stock pictures
as
to pretend
identity.
To be this. I did this fish and chips, and I can honestly say I didn't see it coming. Like to your point, like you mentioned something about Detective Vic,
mm-hmm.
but trying to piece it together. I was like trying to figure out, okay, but why would she, what was her motive? And then when we learn the motive, as a mother, the opposite of what John did. So David is a father. He's trying to find his daughter. He's in anguish. She, as a mother, was only
protecting her son.
Right. You understood the motive.
Yeah. And you you can say that quote-unquote exposition scene was also very well done.
Absolutely.
As static camera as it is when she's giving her confession. Also brilliant, too, because it shows that we saw the son, just little glimpses, literally glimpses of him. But it played well, too. He's also an awkward kid dealing with social media.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you're like, yeah, that's also very believable.
And he had liked her for months, a long time. He didn't know how to approach her. You know, and that too, that is a sign of the times. And I don't know if it'll get any better, because a lot of people who are hiding behind social media, they find life to be awkward. How do I approach this girl that I'm attracted to that I like? I mean, you're in high school. You're supposed to be attracted to somebody or something. But with this and being so, again, you're in this cocoon. That becomes more of real reality than trying to reach out. And the best way he can do it was he made up an avatar of himself.
Fake name, fake account, just to talk to her.
Yeah. So I was like, oh my God. Oh, okay. Oh my God.
Also very believable.
It was believable. Again, I didn't feel cheated at all. And, I guess, Detective Vic went to some pretty extreme measures, which includes murder.
Yeah.
To the
guy, the ex-con that she got involved with this as, first of all, super creepy. I mean, testament to the guy, not dissing his looks or whatever.
The actor, yeah,
he was really good. Way that they shot him,
uh-huh,
he looked like a deranged maniac.
Oh, he did.
That could pull off a murder.
He did.
For an innocent year-old girl. And we're always seeing in the news, people getting killed left and right by completely random crazy guys.
Sure.
And he fit the billing. And how he was actually, his character was actually looking at the camera, looking at the audience, burned into my memory. I'm like, oh, that's a face I don't want to forget. I just want to forget now, but I can't. I think they did that great. Paired up with the actual picture now of the ex-cons, which I was like, ha ha! I had a moment. I was like, you see, I knew it. I knew that picture was shady. I knew it was a shady picture. Oh,
classic, yeah.
I was like, there it is.
Moment. Yeah.
But I couldn't put two and two together just yet until they actually showed it for me. I was like, yeah, I kind of knew.
And you're right. It's about how you piece it together, right? And sometimes
individually you couldn't figure it out.
And
when you put it together,
and again, we see a lot of movies. We talk a lot about movies, and sometimes if there is a twist that a movie relies on, sometimes we've said it here. I've said it many a time. We're like, you get the twist two steps ahead. You're you're piecing it together and you go, oh. And so sometimes you get it about two steps ahead of the protagonist. It didn't happen here.
You're figuring it out as he's figuring it out.
And when he figures it out, it's as much of a aha moment. You go, oh my God, she's a stock photo. What? Oh my God.
What's happening now?
What's going on? What is happening here? Thing is, I'm not sure I'd be so savvy as to be in the computer to figure some of this stuff out.
Well, and also, I think they did a great job also with the quick establishment of the character David and his job.
Yes.
That is literally his job, is to finding numbers and searching. You can easily, from that video conference call he was having at work, you can immediately establish he's a smart guy who knows technology.
Yep.
So, and apply those skills throughout the rest of the movie, you can believe his character is smart enough to pull this off.
There wasn't a time I didn't buy anything that he, or anybody else for that matter, but there wasn't a time where I didn't buy what he was doing. So I totally got that. So, you know, the one thing that we should talk about, too, is a side of directing, right? A lot of this movie is, you know, Juan Sebastian Baron is the cinematographer. And something need be said here because his work needs to be pointed out because it's not like he's setting up... whenever we talk cinematography,
tripods
we talk
about and rigs and
yeah. But whenever we talk cinematography, too, is about oh my god, that looked beautiful. What a beautiful shot, Roger Deakins. You know, he can film the sky
landscapes.
And he can do action and whatever. But we're always talking about how a scene looks, and his he has to take a completely different tack because of how the movie is and. During the shoot, he had to juggle the technical and creative aspects of more than a dozen recording devices used to film the movie, and each which revealed its own set of rules and constraints, and he found himself less occupied with lens choice or dolly movement, since most of the camera's recording were fixed.
Were so, static.
And no attached movement. To a computer mimicking surveillance optics. So... it's funny, Baron and Shiganti, they too met at film school.
Mm-hmm.
And
a lot of people who worked on this film are all USC alums.
Yeah, yeah. Go USC.
Yeah.
Sure.
They did it.
So there was a lot of technology in-house that helped them accomplish the look of the movie. Some of those FaceTime conversations, they had engineered this rig with dummy laptops with GoPros attached to them and LED lights. And they kind of mimic a screen, and they all go into the security camera switching system.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this Frankenstein contraption, like that reference. But it really was the best way to solve the problem of doing scenes where actors are talking to each other via FaceTime. So, you know, again, we always talk about the responsibility, the creativeness of people, and we're talking about cinematography who had to approach this differently. And what the cinematographer had to do to capture scenes, shots, you know, for the editor, right. For the director, and the editor to put everything together.
Also,
so.
Like just the placement of the camera and the lighting. Even Juan Sebastian Baron, he said that for the lighting purposes, also because you know you don't get the best camera quality,
true.
Visual quality when it comes to webcams and stuff like that. But he actually put a lot of thought into the lighting and mood of the rooms. Say like Margot's room, the Christmas lights that were behind were strategically placed, like to establish this is what she would like in her bedroom, or even the creepy ex-con murderer, quote unquote. That video, it's like that light was underneath him.
Yeah.
Shining up, making him look like a creep. With no shadows, right. Shadows of the eyes and stuff, no eyes. Like the lighting he strategically placed to evoke emotion.
Yeah. And to be able to film. And you know, it's interesting because wasn't it Steven Soderbergh who earlier this year, or maybe it was last year, he shot
yeah.
a movie entirely on like an iPhone, right?
iPhone,
so
yeah.
And that's
Sanity,
funny because
Unsane.
He's Unsane, I think.
Yeah, Unsane.
Yeah, that's it. And
it was earlier this year.
Their A camera here was actually Anisha's personal iPhone. And we took the screen life technique up a notch.
Deborah Messing even had a GoPro in her hand.
Yeah.
The scene where she gets the phone call and she's like moving from room to room.
Yeah.
Like Deborah Messing actually has the camera in her hand. Moving.
Yeah. So, imagine the blocking on that. Like, no, a little bit to the left. It's like when we get set up here. We're told where to sit.
Right.
Move a little bit over here. Like,
get
no,
your framing.
Deborah, you got to get your framing done. You know, and because they didn't have 30 cameras, we had to break it down into types of cameras that could give us different looks and different styles that would be authentic. So, and I believe they succeeded. I mean, everything about this movie didn't seem like a cheat. It didn't seem like a special effect. It did seem real and authentic to me.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Almost like we talked about Dateline, like watching something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it had that. And again, you said it at the top of the show. In a sense, we're almost prepped We're conditioned to watch, even when we watch TV. Yeah.
Right, and they Juan also said that he watched a lot of news footage of how helicopter camera operators would capture footage being revealed to them in real time.
Right.
So when we got the live footage, the aerial shots from the so-called helicopter, they framed it in a way that it would look like this would actually be on the news.
Right. And a lot of it, you do feel that you are watching news, watching a news story. So I found that to be, very realistic. And again, it was a tool that helps draw you in a little bit more, I felt. So what else should we talk about?
I really enjoyed the music for this film. Torin Borrowdale, he's also from USC. he worked with Shiganti on other projects, and he's also he interned for Christopher Leonard's, who just did the music for the last film that we just talked about. But like,
the
he's worked
great Muppet Caper.
He's also worked with James Norton Howard, who was like brilliant. Christopher Leonard's Austin Wintory. He's scored over 50 student projects, so he's and a lot of actual television series now. So he has a lot of projects under his belt. So to also work with USC alums too, I really enjoyed the first score, actually, which we opened the show up to. I actually listened to the whole soundtrack because I was really taken by the music, and it's fantastic because the first score is very upbeat, light.
Yep.
In that type of emotional establishment. But then when you listen throughout the rest of the soundtrack, it does sound like a horror thriller soundtrack.
Yeah, and it's a great bed because it never becomes larger than what we're watching. Mm-hmm. It complements it perfectly. And because of that, it affords the audience to organically be on the edge of their seat, or to be wrapped up in this story. So, and again, it's one of those things where the music complements the visuals in such a way that it just adds to the tensity that can be happening, you know, in this movie. And it also denotes things are getting darker as we go along. So I thought that to be very, very interesting. You know, you talked about color and production designer Angel Herrera. She talked about color too. Production designer, it could be a he, I'm sorry. We tried to assign specific palettes to each character so we can identify who we were talking to, like, immediately, not just from the actor, but the space, the feeling. And so going to Margot's tones were greens, the yellows, the soft cream colors, like we're talking. So it was very, very deliberate.
Warm.
We also had a star motif, especially with her and her mother, sort of celestial reference, her mother in the heavens and a metaphor of escape from Margot. Whenever she was with her mother, we pushed the yellow color like a ray of sunshine. With her father David, we stuck more with browns and reds. His brother had a connection to his niece, so he had a color palette similar to Margot. Warmer greens, yellows, she's going on. And we stayed in the blue hues for the detective because she felt like it's a cop color. So it's very interesting. You know, you had brought it up before about the lighting and that, how everything is so deliberate in this movie. And when I think back upon it, makes sense. Yeah. I get it. Yep.
A lot of thought went into this film.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's what I appreciated compared to our last film, which was
awful. Again,
I mentioned that, like, they didn't put a lot of thought into it. This one, I appreciate the thought process. They thought of every detail for this movie.
Well, they did. And it was an attention to detail and story. So, you know, they knew the concept that they were going to use to tell the story, the tool. But if you don't have a story, you ain't got nothing, kid. You got nothing. And you're not going to get me you won't pull me in. So I also find that it's interesting that regarding editing began 7 weeks prior to production, with a totally blank timeline, and worked with Anish taking pictures of space and screenshotting web pages to build out a kind of animatic.
Yep.
So They start 7 weeks before production, meaning they haven't shot anything, but yet they're editing.
They're already visualizing how the screens are going to look.
Yeah.
And Shiganti also joked that this is what he said. He's like, we had a joke that a normal movie is pre-production, production, and post-production. Our movie is pre-post, post, post-post. Because it only took 13 days to film all the actors and, you know, the locations for this film.
Sure.
It took a year and a half for the editing of
this
film.
It. I mean, 13
days
it.
Compared to a year and a half of
editing. I believe it. And because of that feat, like, if I was Sony, I would be pushing that for, like, Editing Academy Awards.
Oh, absolutely.
For the time spent, you know? So, but they did love, they used Avid. You know, we love Avid, but it would have been too weird of a workflow. So we'd have been too locked in the case of searching effects. Everything that didn't come straight out of a camera on set was an effect that we had to create. So this is funny. So say the top of the Google Chrome had to all be created from scratch. We worked with an outside vendor named Neon Robotic, tell them who they are, to create some templates for us, and they were a huge help for building some of the more complex assets like the iMessage, Chrome Docs, stuff like that.
Yeah.
But then other than that, it was just me, Will, Adobe, After Effects, and another design tool, Illustrator. Replicating everything.
I love After Effects and Illustrator. I use them every single day here for our studios. And also, they said one of their biggest challenges was that editing and rendering, their computers kept crashing. They used two iMacs. So, like, if you think about it, these guys are young. Shiganti is actually younger than me. And now it just makes me wonder, what the hell am I doing with my life? He has a huge movie out in theaters, and I'm still here.
You're talking about the movie.
Slouch. But they were working on two iMacs. Like, this could have been me editing. And they said every time they were rendering, their computers kept crashing. So, every time they had, like, a special shot, they were like, they would tell their editors, come back in 20 minutes, because it would take 20 minutes to render just one shot.
Yeah, and like you said, it took over a year. There were two editors working full-time. And even though they were working modern age of digital and non-linear editing, the level of detail that they had to bring to each scene felt like we were cutting on an old moviola. Look it up. It's not the way editing's done today. It's just, you know, we're used to seeing things instantly because of sheer size of files and programs. Come back
and
in an
if they're
hour.
Using Avid on a regular iMac, yeah, I mean, no that, kidding. That's not like a Disney Pixar film where they have humongous hard drives that could take all the footage and render it properly.
Right.
They're doing it on regular computers.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, and again, it plays to the authenticity of the movie, in which we understand today. And this technology, it's not going away anytime soon.
Right.
And the mere fact that we can FaceTime with somebody in another country.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to me, that's Star Trek technology. When they were able to put somebody up in the view screen on the Enterprise who was on the planet while they're on the ship, and they were able to talk and have a conversation, that's happening today, you know, with video stuff. So I don't see that technology really. I see it getting better, perhaps, but I don't see it going away. And that's another reason why I don't think the movie will end up dating itself too much, too drastically. Say within 10, 20 years.
Right. And you still get the good story. I only say that because, like, XP was the first thing we see on the screen, and that's no longer in service.
No.
So just what we know as technology now with the Microsoft and Mac and whatever, the desktop and whatever OS system you're using, that's not going to be there in 20 years.
Yeah, and it was funny that they were using the XP, because as soon as I
loved
heard
XP. That,
see, it made me cringe when I heard it. I was like, oh. So
I loved XP.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've talked a lot about, well, I think we've done our research on this movie.
Of searching. I got to give it to them, though, to how this movie was even, it was picked up at Sundance.
Yeah.
For $5 million for world Right.
Right. And so, you know, another thing that was sort of unorthodox about this movie was its release pattern. This movie had two releases. It had a limited release on August 24th. It mm-hmm. came out in only 9 locations across the country. Anyone guesses? It was somewhere in New York or LA. And the movie didn't open wide until August 31st. And you know, and now here's the interesting thing. This is a Sony picture. Sony is a major studio within its right. Spider-Man, they're going to have Venom coming out. They've had actually a pretty decent year. They too
compared
are getting,
to the first few years or like
well,
the last few years.
They're getting back up on their feet after the hack. Mm-hmm. They've had major changes going on. They're getting back up on their feet. So this movie was wide for them. It's 1,200 locations, which by blockbuster standards, they're about 3,000 short. But still, you know, it's not, it's just interesting that they would take this movie. At, I mean, I've seen the trailer
a few times
in the movie theater. Saw it on, you know, I've seen advertising on TV. But it was an interesting way to roll out this film. And as soon as they started rolling it out, even in the 9 locations, it was getting really solid reviews. I mean, Rotten Tomatoes, you got 91% on Rotten Tomatoes. So the critics were really enjoying this movie. And again, this experiment could have gone horribly, horribly wrong when you think about it.
It
could have been Happy Time Murders. Like, mm-hmm. or it could have been like, you know, those other, like Dark Web, Unfriended. It could have sort of kind of been like a movie like those as well.
Right. Now, I didn't see Unfriended because I think that movie is like listed as a horror thriller. And
right.
Marissa doesn't do horror. So I didn't go see this one. But I think what also helps in this film is that you do have already established actors. You have Deborah Messing and John Cho. So that does help bring an audience.
Right. Yeah, I don't disagree. And do you have the numbers? I'm trying to bring them up here. And
as of September 5th, I have domestically it's made about $9.5 million, so give or take, you know, maybe $500,000 of that. Foreign, it's at like a little bit over $7 million. So worldwide, right. It's about 16.5,
which is okay. You know, not too bad. Again, you know, I'm actually what are we looking at? Yeah, 16.5 domestic, 9.5 foreign. You know, you got to look at it too. From a foreign perspective, you look at, okay, who's going to bring in the box office? $7 million isn't too bad for this movie. Look, I love John Cho.
And
but
this
I
is
wouldn't...
a fairly lower production.
Oh, movie. Absolutely. They're going to make their money back.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And look, no slight. I don't mean in no disrespect. I mean, but John Cho isn't a huge box office, like, bring her in. Like,
yeah,
people,
draw.
But a draw. And, but still, I would say that 16.5 worldwide, not too shabby. They released it like an art film. And I don't disagree with going out on 9 and then going wider. I wish they had maybe gone even wider than 1,200. Like, go 25 because your reviews were there. And I really do think that the audience, I think whoever sees this is really going to enjoy it for what it is. And they're going to be brought in. The audience I saw with was really, they stayed to the end on their edge of their seat. Like they,
audience applauded after this film ended. They like legit applauded. And I mean, and this film premiered at Sundance. It got great rave reviews already there. So well that, you know, Sundance or like Sony bought them within 12 hours. And they won the next audience award at Sundance, and they also won the Alfred P. Sloan Feature Film Prize for works pertaining to science or technology. So this film already had accolades before it went to wide theaters.
Yeah, and you know, the thing is that I haven't seen a stronger push for its subsequent weeks because Well, this week it's going to go up against The Nun, which is unfortunate because, I mean,
horror
The
Nun's
going to be really
humongous.
Big. Yeah, and this is part of a world this is going to do, by all accounts, it's going to do very well. And then Searching, I think, sort of kind of is going to get just lost in the tide pool.
Yeah, Searching had Labor Day weekend for them.
It did, but I have to say it was probably one of the weakest Labor Days going into Labor Day. Nothing.
Really no other movies.
And I wanted to see Searching. I almost wish Sony just gave it a little more TLC. Like, push it out more. Mm-hmm. Like, make a big deal of this because this is a really good movie. Cheat it a little bit if you want to. Maybe cheat it as if it were a horror film. Get that teen audience to go in there because they're going to like it. They're going to like it. It's not boring at all. It's paced pretty well.
Yeah, not once did it lose my attention.
Nay, nay. So, let's go final thoughts. We'll start wrapping up this Search.
And you know, I really enjoyed it because I went into it not knowing what to expect and I came out like mind blown. I would actually see this film a few more times just to pick up like other things I might have missed because there is so much on screen it's basically impossible to catch everything. So missing Catfish, I would definitely see this film again.
You bring
There's
up
a rewatchability
you
factor.
Bring up a good point because this is one of those movies that I wonder if they purposely left clues for us to try to figure it out.
Oh yeah, they,
you
know, actually
what I mean?
Shiganti and O'Hanahan, they had private screenings for their friends. They legitimately had their friends watch the film,
yeah,
and then break down like the shots in the script. And they're like, "Could you pick up on any of the clues we showed you that would give away the ending?" And so people, they gauged whether people were fully paying attention and what they paid attention to compared to, like, the magic trick, like, your attention is here, but actually right. The answer is, like, on the left side of the screen instead of the right.
Interesting.
So, like, they had the details in front of you, but were you
so they were there.
Paying attention?
Yeah, well, you know, and the thing is that I believe that I was paying attention. I was engrossed. Mm-hmm. I was drawn into this movie, and they did such a good job that when the reveal comes and the mystery is solved, I was like, whoa, all right, I didn't see that coming. That works. That really worked. And, you know, it's interesting when you rewatch movies like, say, The Usual Suspects, right?
Yeah.
It's got a great rewatchability because in a movie like that, Bryan Singer does leave you the clues throughout. But it's just not plain in your face. Like, they're not putting an arrow to. So this movie doesn't put an arrow,
together.
Right? And that, I think, is part of the enjoyment of rewatching a movie like that. I think the same is going to hold true for rewatching Searching. Like, you'll go, oh, how did I miss? Okay.
Yep.
Now I know how
it
ends. Oh, yeah, it was there.
Yeah.
Wow, well, smart. So it's a really good movie. Glad you've seen it. Tell your friends to go see it. Marissa, where can people find you?
Everyone can follow me everywhere at Serafini TV.
But you're on other shows here on the Popcorn Talk Network.
Yeah.
Well, or Anatomy or
Anatomy
AfterBuzz.
Movie. Our sister network, AfterBuzz TV.
Sure.
I do a lot.
She does do a lot. And again, my name is Dimitri. You can support me on Twitter, at DMovies1701. Please support. I usually send out a ton of tweets about movies because I love movies. You find me here in Anatomy of a Movie, Popcorn Talks Anatomy of a Movie. I'm also a frequent guest on Popcorn Talk Network's Meet the Movie Press. We have a ton of fun talking about the biz, and it's about movies. We have a lot of fun doing that. So please join us. We've got more movies coming up in the month of September and October. We are on the fringe. We're on the precipice of award
season.
You know, the second trailer for Halloween dropped this week. I can't wait. That's going to be in October. But there's plenty of movies between now and then. Hey, if you missed a show or you saw something on HBO or something, 9 out of 10 times, we broke it down. go on to Anatomy of a Movie and check us all out. And
you guys talk about Unfriended.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Go
yeah,
check we talk out that
about
anatomy.
Horror movies. You know, we'll be talking about The Nun. Maybe not you.
Maybe, not
maybe
me.
You will. Yeah, come on, we'll The Nun.
Lots of movies. Lots We've been movies. Here for 5 years.
5 years with 600 shows under our belt.
Yep.
All right. Well, thanks, folks, for tuning in. We're glad you found us. We're glad we found you.
You searched for
See
us.
See you later.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network. The views expressed herein are those of the host only and do not necessarily reflect the views of its owners or principals.